What's this?
I'm speechless.
Have I been here before?
I'm speechless. I've forgotten how to do this. How does it work?
I don't know.
Oh, there's people here.
Mm.
Hi, people.
Say hello to the people.
It's been a while. 5 weeks.
Month.
A month. We'll call it a month. It's been a while. Yeah.
Lock going been on. A month,
yeah. Yeah.
4 weeks.
4 weeks. On the last news reel, it was the day after Iran attacked Israel for no reason whatsoever. Everyone held their collective breath. You remember that moment? It was just 24 hours and they calmed down because Armageddon was upon us.
Right now.
But you here were calling it right away. You said,
on
nope,
Twitter.
Nope, that's it. Things will settle down
now. I was making fun of it on Twitter as it was happening.
of the drones.
Yes.
Well. Which has been the case. You're right.
Anyway. But that's old news.
I know.
Is anything compared to that? No.
Well, no. Not, we haven't had Armageddon, right? For the structural reasons you explained, it just can't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Last Sunday, though, it was like, well, you tell me, I think no one is seriously arguing that there was foul play involved, but it is weird what happened to the Iranian president.
Mm-hmm.
It was killed in a helicopter accident.
Mm-hmm.
Last Sunday, along with the foreign minister.
Mm-hmm.
I forget his name, but people know his face because he's popped up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Not just over Iran's diplomacy around the Palestine situation, but Iran's diplomacy via China with Saudi Arabia and others in the Middle East. He's been a key player in that. So he's lost as well. It's a double tragedy. Now, our blink on it, like everyone else, was an accident. You thought, well, he's a president. He's replaceable. This isn't a catastrophe for Iran. But it's interesting to me, though, that, in fact, in the condolences that were said, Putin's in particular, he described him as irreplaceable. Now, obviously, he knows him better and so on, and maybe he knows the Iranian system better. It's been written about, even in Western media, that he was a favorite of the Ayatollah and was a possible successor as supreme leader, imam, whatever, of the mullahs in Iran. So that is a serious blow. It's a hell of a thing to happen. And it just shows you that geopolitics can be obviously conspiracies afoot, schemes and plots and whatnot. But there's this X factor, you know, that no one can fully account for. There was one gripe from the Iranian side. Well, this wouldn't have happened if we weren't sanctioned up the wazoo and our helicopters, you know, weren't so old and rickety.
Right.
For sure. The weather was mad. I think it was a fine enough day when they set out. And then a cloud bank descended. And there were three choppers in convoy. One got lost, and that was his. The others circled around to find him, and they couldn't. Another thing that I found curious was that he was meeting. I just met, or was it canceled? I'm not sure. The leader of Azerbaijan. Because the whole thing did smack initially of something geopolitical, because he's obviously meeting the head of his neighbor. They were opening a joint dam, which is an interesting development itself, because Azerbaijan and Iran are at loggerheads, to the extent that Azerbaijan is happy to have Israel be its number one weapons provider, which obviously is, you know, a pain in the neck for Iran, you know. So they were obviously working around that with, you know, Chinese-style good neighborly relations. And they were at the border to open the dam, and then he was going home, and this happened.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It kind of right there, you go, there's a possible Israeli / geopolitical intrigue, motive or setup. But no, it really was an accident.
Says who?
Oh, well, okay. I should ask you. What do you think? Are you leaving it open? Because Iran's been quiet about suggesting such sense.
Yeah, but the problem is when you get assassinated or someone, you assassinate someone or some member of your country gets assassinated, some member of your political leadership gets assassinated. You can't just turn around and say the dirty Jews did this or because that's what the Iranians would say, right, in not so many words.
Yeah.
The Zionists did this, the Jews did this, without evidence. Because no one's going to take you seriously, because you could say that at any time. Anything goes bad, the Jews did it. And then you start to look ridiculous.
Mm.
The Jews did it. You know, I stubbed my toe on the wardrobe. The Jews did it, you know. You can't just come out and say, without evidence, that anybody killed any member of your political establishment without evidence. You can't just make that allegation. And obviously, when countries assassinate, which happens very often, all the time, when some countries assassinate the political members or political members of the political class of another country, they often do it in a way that there isn't a way for anybody to blame anybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole point, right? You don't want to. It's not like you're. So like if America wants to assassinate a Russian or whatever, they don't want to assassinate the Russians and have the whole world say, you know, or have be able to tell the whole world, yeah, we did that, screw you, Russia. You know, that very often, more often than not, they want to do it completely anonymously.
Uh-huh.
In which case, the country who suffers the assassination can literally say nothing publicly because they have no evidence. They're not going to say, they're not going to make spurious, what appear to be spurious allegations. And in fact, for them, they are spurious allegations until you would develop some, or engage in some long process of investigative process of the actual disaster or assassination, whatever caused them to die, and then find evidence and then be able to bring it to somewhat the Hague or to the International Court, or at least bring it to public attention. You bring it to public attention.
I would have thought there'd be something for them to insinuate at. Quite fairly quickly. It's been a week they haven't made anything like that. Here's a contrast. When a lunatic fired three times at the Prime Minister of Slovakia the day before,
uh-huh,
or 2 days before that, within 48 hours, the Slovakian government said,
mm-hmm,
oh, well, this is weird. We found that someone wiped his social media accounts. Someone, not us.
Yeah.
And we're investigating his ties
to
ideological groups,
mm-hmm,
possibly foreign.
That's an example. Network. That's an example of what I'm talking about. When you have evidence, you come up with.
So the Iranian one would be, well, it in this scenario, it would be so squeaky clean that they've just yet to find
totally
a crumb.
Well, it's a totally different scenario. You're comparing two very different scenarios. It's some guy who points a gun, has a history, they investigate him, they arrest him and find out who he is quickly, and then they make allegations. Totally normal. When a helicopter goes down in a cloud in a mountain, who are you going to point the finger at? Immediately. Or within even...
So are you just keeping it open, or...?
Well, because it's totally plausible that... I mean, somebody could have put... In theory, could have put a bomb on his... or some kind of a... Some kind of device on his helicopter.
Uh-huh.
In theory, some kind of insider. It happens. It's you know, you'd hope it wouldn't. The security would be that lax. But, the Israelis have shown over the years that they have a lot of access to inside Iran. I mean, they've been killing Iranian scientists, placing bombs on, or having their agents place bombs on their cars and that kind of stuff, you know, inside, in Tehran, right? Some agent of Israel, I'm not talking about some Hasidic Jew or you know,
it's typically been a member of the MEK.
Yeah, or someone that they've contracted in some way or
weird
other.
Weird opposition group.
Yeah, or somebody within the country who they have access to, who can work has been working undercover. A sleeper cell.
Of course, if he's in or near Azerbaijan, Israel has access there.
Mm-hmm.
Shit. Yeah, okay, well, that is possible, for sure. I didn't want... I discounted that because I remember the Polish president's plane going down in Russia. Although that was in a quieter time. Mm. And Poland...
And Smolensk.
Smolensk, you know, which was... investigated up the wazoo and found to be an accident, for sure. Although the longer the investigation went on, the more suspicious and hysterical Poland became, to the point now where something like 50% of Poles polled
think Russia was sabotage. So for me, obviously there's no way to really know, like I said, in those kind of situations it can be done absolutely, you know, anonymously, to the point that there's no evidence whatsoever. Even the people investigating the crash of this helicopter wouldn't have any way really to tell if it if it came down, just by accident, by mechanical fault or something, or whether it was sabotage, would be very difficult to tell. It would take a long time.
Especially in a fog, there's no visual, external visual. It's harder to see or verify, even with technology.
So in that kind of situation, the only thing you're left to look at is the context in which it happens. You know, the geopolitical context, or the political context in which it happens. And, you know, after what's been going on for the past, 30 years with Israeli and U.S., you know, particularly Israeli warmongering against Iran. And sabotage and all that kind of stuff. Then, and the fact that it was one of three helicopters, and you've got 30, if one of them's going to go down in fog in a mountain range, and I'm assuming they're all flying in relatively close formation, because why do you have three? They're flying, they're all going to the same place. It's, it's three went there, three came back, they're flying close together. The helicopter with the Iranian president and defense minister, etc., has a 33% chance of not, or has a 66% chance of not being the one to go down, but it happens to be the one that goes down. It just, for me, on balance, I mean, obviously I don't know, but on balance, I would say probability tends towards it being sabotage.
Yeah, because of the specific geopolitical circumstances of Israel-Iran and the Armageddon incident the month before that.
And like you said, you have to know a little bit before finishing that. You have to know a little bit about the internals of Iran and the president, the profile, the political profile, or the who the president was, what his attitude, who he was as a person, what his perspective was, and also his foreign minister. And you mentioned the Russian, Putin saying he was irreplaceable. Obviously, that means that's technically true of anybody. They're irreplaceable because there's only one of each person on the planet. But you could take it in that respect that he was just being nice and saying he's irreplaceable. But again, he's making a political comment and suggests that it means that, that this guy was particularly good and had, you know, if Putin said he was irreplaceable, that means Russia liked him.
Yeah.
Because, Iran isn't absolutely 100%, let's say, on board with the whole, necessarily, like, I wouldn't say internally it's not 100% on board with the whole multipolarity and Russia and China axis versus the West, you know what I mean? There's still maybe some room for manipulation, maneuvering there.
We could pull internally. It up, but he said specifically it was great working with him because we made great leaps or moves towards something like full strategic partnership.
Mm-hmm.
That Iran, you're right, they're not there yet, but they might end up being something like the unprecedented extent of strategic.
That's a process.
Coherence that Russia and China.
That's a process that's ongoing, and obviously the Iranians have to be brought around to that, and you have different personalities. You have more, you've got hardliners and more secular type people in Iran, and so, there's all of that as well. So the Israelis would have been obviously done their homework and all of that as well, and I've been watching that very closely in terms of the types of personalities that are in power in Iran. And maybe they decided that it was beneficial for them to take these two guys out and then kind of have a sort of a reset or make it more difficult, let's say. I mean, they'd be willing to do that if they even saw a minimal advantage to them.
A minimal short-term
advantage.
Marginal gain, why not?
It wouldn't bother them to do it if they had the opportunity.
Crikey. One other contextual thing is, I alluded to it before, within the space of 4 or 5 days, assassination attempt, clearly, on Robert Fico, Prime Minister of Slovakia, some kind of a threat made against Erdogan that required intervention in Turkey, and that's happened to him before with the mutiny that became a coup in 2016. Another assassination threat, I'm not sure, attempt, I don't know how far along they get, but against Vukic, Prime Minister of Serbia. The Iranian president's accident, and I think there was a fifth one. And since then, this is, I put it as the main topic. I don't know how much attention we want to give to it, but the Prime Minister of Georgia has said he was threatened with an allusion to what happened to FICO. You know, if you don't want things to go a certain way, look at what happened to him. So that's, it's in a climate of, oh, and then there was a coup in Congo as well, an aborted attempted military coup in Congo. That all happened very close together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You wonder, I'm not suggesting these things are all coordinated together, but maybe something in the air, you know what I mean? Impinges on some of them. There is connection between some
these people. They're kind of off the rails, you know what I mean? It's like the last one you mentioned, the Georgian Prime Minister. I'm not even going to pronounce his name, or maybe I am. Kobakidze. Anyway, Georgian Prime Minister Kobakidze, this is it here, said he was warned by a European commissioner that if his government goes ahead with controversial foreign agent law, he should be very careful in light of the recent assassination attempt of Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico. Of course, this the EU commissioner then, I think he was a French guy, was he?
He's named. People can look it up. He didn't hide it or deny it. He admitted it.
No, he came out and he came out.
There he is. The EU Enlargement Commissioner, naturally.
Yeah.
Oliver Varhelyi, I don't know.
Varhelyi.
Varhelyi is probably
The second one is this EU Commissioner denying he threatened Georgia's Prime Minister, says his words about referring to Fico were taken out of context. So, yeah, how do you take that? How do you do that? I mean, really, it's like, you could see how this EU commissioner was saying, you know, you better calm down on the foreign, what do you call it, the foreign agent law. The guy said he said you'd be very careful, you know, about, you know, following through on this foreign agent law, which, just for people who don't know, it's basically a law that the Georgian government is trying to push through, or is pushing through, I think, or has done, that would force any foreign monies being, any groups within Georgia being, you know, using foreign monies would have to declare it, right? And it's weird, like, because it's super anti-democratic in a certain sense. They'd say the West would say, it's obviously Western money. It's like the Georgian government want to make it a legal requirement for, let's say, NGO groups or any groups within the country who are getting money from foreign governments to declare it. And people are supposedly out in the streets saying, this is terrible, how could you possibly do that? It's super anti-democratic. It's like, what do you mean? It's like, we need to know which foreign governments are dumping money into our country or using money in our country for whatever reasons. And everybody's like, no, that's terrible. And of course, the Russians are in support of that because the Russians and Chinese and other countries are obviously... have dealt with that before, basically foreign NGOs in the country using foreign money, USAID, all that kind of stuff, to try and subvert the country from within. So it's totally democratic for them to want to have this law passed.
A bit more background on this. Georgia's population is 3 million people, okay? It has something like 26,000 NGOs.
Mm-hmm.
Vast majority of which are foreign, which is like something like one registered per number of people you're seeing in these protests. Because that's all it is, the hardcore of anti-government.
So it's basically saying we need to know about a massive fifth column within our country. We need to know where it's, you know, who these people are and what their intentions are.
It's the whole thing is cooked. They're saying they're shorthanding it in Western press to the Russian law. Fuck off. The law in question. The U.S. has had a law like this, not as strict on its books since 1938. Georgia is just trying to stop the rot because, like I said, it's similar to Ireland. There's just thousands of NGOs and they're not Irish.
Yeah.
But they activate Irish agents. Anyway.
And from the West point of view.
Let's say activists. And this happened perfectly. So the government proposed it. They went to table the motion in Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And that night is when the protest began,
mm-hmm.
like with a bang behind them, because literally those activists/agents were called out on the streets. Mm-hmm. And it didn't just begin the protests slowly, slowly, slowly. They went straight and they tried to smash down the parliament doors mm-hmm. that night. Mm-hmm. They have, in fact, since breached it and been inside.
So that was the fact that the protests happened and have happened so supposedly spontaneously is evidence of
why we need this law.
But from the Western perspective, it's anti-democratic for Georgia to want to have full transparency over foreign influence in this country. It's like democracy is allowing us access to your political and economic establishment basically within your country. That's democracy. And
literally,
we can do whatever we want. And if you try to stop us, if you say, no, I want to see what you all are doing, you foreigners are all doing in my country, foreign government agents are doing in my country, then that's anti-democratic apparently.
Which is obviously a lie. And the lie is exposed by the fact that the government in Georgia that's trying to pass this law, which will succeed, actually, I'll explain why in a second. The Georgia Dream Party, which is really a coalition. There's a Georgia Dream Party, and then it's become the Georgia Dream Coalition. Anyway, it has won the last three general elections handsomely in Georgia, the latest one being in 2020. It is the democratically elected government of Georgia. They passed this vote for the Foreign Agents Registration Act easily, handsomely, 80-something to 20-something. The protests kick off, and they're, you know, under serious pressure to repeal it. It didn't happen. The president, according to Georgia's constitution, can veto it, and she did. However, she doesn't have that. She doesn't have executive power like, say, a Macron in France. Mm-hmm. And so all that's required in Georgia, the country of Georgia, is for the parliament to retable the motion, which they, I think, have since done. So mm-hmm. it's now law. Mm-hmm. Didn't work. Mm-hmm. But that stunt of getting the president to veto it was an act that just rekindled the protests, which is why they're sort of flared up the second time now in the last month and are ongoing as we speak. And it's, you know, the Russian law, and they're not even pushing it too much that it's the democratic will of the people of Georgia to allow foreign NGOs in, and how mm-hmm. dare you? What they're saying is, you're either for Europe or you're against it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know, Georgians, naturally, of course, they're for Europe. Look at them, they're all waving the EU flag on the streets. Yeah, but that's not what the electorate have said.
Mm-hmm.
Even on Wikipedia's page about this Georgian Dream political party, it says ideology, social market economy. They're technically a lefty party, but they're Georgian nationalists, but quite lefty as well. Social conservatism, that would make them more on the right, and soft Euroscepticism.
Mm-hmm.
This mix is so reminiscent of the Maidan.
Mm-hmm.
Yanukovych wasn't hardcore anti-Europe anything. He made a deal and then said, well, actually, can we just put a timeout on it? This EU accession thing, can we just wait a bit on it? Because, you know, the Russians reminded them, dude, your economy is like totally connected with ours. And that, in the space of October, November, December, in the space of 4 months, led to the Maidan coup.
Mm-hmm.
Snipers on the streets. Snipers on the street, on the rooftops. Remember, those snipers were actually found out. They were Georgian mercenaries,
mm-hmm.
which is another interesting tie-in with this. Georgia, of course, pops up in the war in Ukraine a lot as well. There's Georgia Foreign Legion,
mm-hmm.
many of whom aren't actually Georgian.
Mm-hmm.
But the recruiting and training of them takes place in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And they come from all over. They mm-hmm. could be Muslims from the Central Asian stands, or whoever the hell they are, and Georgia is kind of a work through mm-hmm. for Western interests, and then they become part of the Georgia Foreign Legion,
mm-hmm.
which has huge numbers of fighters in Ukraine. Although they're not Georgia's, like we said, it's a tiny country; it doesn't have that many fighters,
mm-hmm.
but it's a kind of laundering vehicle for the Ukraine war,
mm-hmm.
anyway, and it has been since the snipers on the rooftops of late January 2014, mm-hmm. the Maidan.
Mm-hmm.
And my hunch, when those protests flared up first in Georgia because of the announcement that they wanted to pass this law, was, here we go. They're going to do...
I'll try.
They're going to try and open a second front I tweeted this on May 16th, and I wasn't, you know, I could see this is where it's going, but I thought it, like, the Euromaidan took many months of shaping it from a pro-EU flower power protest into what it became. This might happen much faster. Oh, that's the wrong tweet. Hang on a second. No, I don't have it. Don't. Okay.
It's on your timeline.
Huh?
On your timeline. It'll be on your timeline.
It'll be on my timeline, but from weeks ago. We may not have been here, but I've been retweeting like mad. I'll be scrolling for ages to find it. Anyway, I said that this is, they're going to open a second front.
Mm-hmm.
This is what, well, this is what they could do. Since then, what's his name again? Georgia's Prime Minister. He's gone on the counteroffensive. Not only has he revealed that the European Union Commissioner for Enlargement subtly or not subtly threatened him with assassination. Let's see if I got the right tweet here. He's been giving interviews in Georgia that just cut straight to the chase.
Mm-hmm.
Arguing that the NATO countries have been after Georgia, blah, 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 to convert it into another front line against Russia. That's Glenn mm-hmm. Deason's reading of it. So have a listen. You won't be able to hear it, but you can read the subs.
მეორე ფრონტი ხო კიდევ ხო გამიმეორებ 2022 წლის დასაწყისიდან უკვე იყო სერიოზული ინტერესი საქართველოს მიმართ რომ აქ გახსნილიყო მეორე ფრონტი რაც რა თქმა უნდა სერიოზულად დააზიანებდა ასე ვთქვათ რუსეთის პოზიციებს ორ ფრონტზე ბრძოლა არ იქნებოდა მარტივი რუსეთისთვის მაგრამ ეს ყველაფერი გაანადგურებდა ჩვენს ქვეყანას მაგრამ ნუ ვიღაცებს არ ადარდებდა საერთო ჩვენი ქვეყნის ბედი ერთ-ერთი რაც აინტერესებდათ იყო რუსეთის პოზიციების შეზღუდვა
Mm-hmm. Straight to the chase. what he's saying, what's going on now is because it's a second front for NATO to get at Georgia. So mm-hmm. I like that. I like how he's either they're going to easily, you know, castigate him as a Kremlin plant and all that nonsense. Mm-hmm. But that's not what he is that he's not ideologically aligned with the West in that. Like them, he's aware of what the true purpose of this is, but unlike them, he doesn't think it's good for his country.
Mm-hmm.
Duh, if you saw what's happened to Ukraine, mm-hmm. why would you want to go through all this? Here, I have a great idea, guys. Let's repeat the Ukraine experiment. Have our country wrecked to pieces, but we'll go down in flames as martyrs to European Union enlargement for American Western/imperial interest.
Mm-hmm.
No, why bother? Let's just cut straight to the chase and say what this is really about. And he can do that confidently tell Georgian people on their TV news because he knows he has the mandate, the electoral mandate
mm-hmm.
to do so.
Mm-hmm. I think that one I just sent you, Scotty, is on the same topic. This is the Lithuanian foreign minister. Go ahead and play it. Does he speak in English? Maybe. Probably does.
Dear friends, dear brothers and sisters, I want to speak clearly to the people of Georgia. And this includes the government of Georgia, the parliament, the police, the military, teachers, doctors, bakers, people in the streets. I am speaking out because I'm on Georgia's side, on the side of European Georgia.
Yeah, European Georgia. So it's all about, you know, yeah, we want to be part of Europe, blah, 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 trying to whip people up. And it's strange that so he's in Georgia.
In Tbilisi. How do you pronounce that, the capital?
Oh, is that in Tbilisi?
Yes.
Okay.
That was about three weeks ago in the first wave of the protest.
Tbilisi is in Lithuania.
No, it's the capital of Georgia.
It is?
Yeah. Tbilisi is the capital of Georgia, and he flies in with two other foreign ministers, also okay. Baltic countries, I think. Again totally reminiscent of November, December 2014, yes. When McCain, Verhofstadt from Brussels.
Yeah, but how does that happen?
Did you notice
where you get like you're a country, a sovereign nation, and the foreign minister of another country gets to come into your country, into your capital, address your people, and encourage them
and the military
encourage them. Let me finish. Encourage them to oppose government policy. I mean, does that happen anywhere else? I mean, like, would, you know, a Russian, would Lavrov be allowed to go to Washington, D.C., stand up in the streets in Washington, D.C., and
encourage the military and the police to reconsider their allegiances to the government?
Yeah.
Yeah. What it shows you is the extent to which Georgia is already far, far gone.
Yeah.
It's the tragedy is here. Something good is not going to come out of this, at least in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
Absent... They have a leader right now who is smart. I mean, the smartest thing to do would just be to call bluff on all the bullshit and forego the forestalling efforts. All this is meant to forestall the one obvious decision, which is basically to make a direct appeal to Moscow to intervene militarily now, pretty much. At least to send signals that they would do so, if this was to go any further.
But that might just encourage.
But
more,
if in
more,
the meantime, yeah. the McCains of the West... The ultra-NATO rabid types can come in and basically say, hello, I come in peace from Brussels and Washington. Please encourage your military to overthrow the government like you're a sitting duck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why this is on a knife edge. I would normally think this would take months. It took the Maidan months to develop from, yay, peace in Europe and, oh, Russia bad, to... what it became, but this could happen. They could be desperate. They could be in a hurry to do this faster, sooner rather than later.
It's obviously it's tricky. You can't just if the Russians were to send in some kind of military force, you would
if asked.
No, but even if asked, you both would have to consider very carefully in terms of giving. Adding fuel to the fire, basically, and encouraging the thing that they're trying to prevent,
uh-huh.
Because it would give justification for them pumping in more more color revolution.
Yes, given the access the West already has.
Exactly,
there.
Yeah.
Do you remember that Bulgarian journalist, pre-COVID, she had her great articles, and she was going around places in Georgia. The U.S. Pentagon... DOD / Fort Detrick in Maryland, they have multiple sites in Georgia where they're conducting biowarfare experiments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Since at least the last couple of decades.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So it's difficult, to know what to do in that situation. You would do it, if you're going to do anything, you'd be working, and long before now as well, you'd be trying to work on the ground covertly, in a way that... encourages the current Georgian government, to be able to defend itself against this kind of
mob rule / Trojan horse.
Yeah.
Do you see when the first night of protest, there was a beautiful, I couldn't find it again for the show. I'm sure people can remember if it passed through your feed somewhere. For me, it captured metaphorically and literally what going on here. It was like a close-up shot, maybe three guys dressed Maidan style with gas masks and makeshift armor, draped in the EU flag like a cloak, another slogans in English and stuff, taking a police cordon, like a metal grill, just one section of it, and together banging it against the door of the parliament.
Mm-hmm.
Boom. Boom. Three ugly looking masked, quasi armored Georgian protesters against the evil government trying to use a battering ram in the name of the European Union to let us in.
Mm-hmm.
We are coming in and we are taking over this place.
Mm-hmm.
And we're desperate because we know we don't have the democratic mandate of the people.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do it fast. Mm-hmm. Before you can even react, the whole thing smells of that.
Yeah, I mean the geography of the whole situation there is. It's been a conflict zone for quite a while. You have South Ossetia, which is a little enclave into Georgia from Russia. Yeah. And then you have Abkhazia and over on the Black Sea coast. That kind of, so Georgia currently is already kind of, to some extent, to one extent or another, kind of split into three separate sections, although the two enclaves are small. So Russia, you know,
already has cards to use.
Yeah, and Russia obviously has a presence and has had a presence in there for a long time as well, you know. So it's almost like this is just great game kind of stuff, great geopolitical game kind of stuff, you know, where it's great powers fighting over chunks of land that are, although in the modern day it's not so much about resources as opposed to, in this case, it's Russia trying to defend itself against the, you know, attempts by the Western elite
to batter down the door and take it piecemeal.
Yeah, to take Russia apart, you know. It's just another... So, yeah, this is just trying to give Russia another headache, basically.
Yeah.
Something to deal with, you know. So,
if 2022 was part two to 2014 in Ukraine, we could be watching part two to 2008 in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
That's where Russia put its foot down over South Ossetia.
Mm-hmm.
And that nutcase, what was his name? Saakashvili.
Saakashvili.
He was the first battering ram. That's obviously the most convenient way. They had their color revolution, an earlier version. Mm-hmm. They got him in power.
But it's reverted to.
But the Georgians saw through that. Yes, yeah. They saw through that.
Well, like you said, the last two elections have been effectively a you know, pro-Russian, or certainly not a. non-pro-Western government in Georgia in the last three elections. So it's, you know, in that respect, I'd say it's fairly, and that's, you know.
You think this can't go anywhere, but.
Well, yeah, I think it's less chance of going somewhere than it has in Ukraine, in a certain sense. Because, unless they have a coup, obviously they need to have a coup, in the same way they had a coup in Ukraine.
Snipers on the rooftop.
Yeah, but Georgia also is less. It's a lot smaller than Ukraine, and you know it's less favorable, kind of geographically less favorable to or less viable to launch a kind of have a major conflict. You know, a conflict that would drag out like it is in Ukraine, in Georgia. Don't know, but it's just yeah. You wouldn't, let's put it this way, you wouldn't go there to live right now. You know, you'd hedge your bets. You wouldn't move there right now.
No, indeed. Well, Georgians are moving out like never before. Do you know that in Ireland, per capita, the number one, the largest migrant group is Georgians?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Especially in the last 2-3 years.
Hmm.
This, the government, or EU, whoever's doing this, it seems to be favoring Georgian migration. There are there's a whole agency in Georgia set up by the Irish government, I think, or EU, under EU auspices to bring them over.
Yeah. The vast majority of immigration in the world right now, in the West, let's say, the immigration that's talked about in Western media and in Western countries, the vast majority of migration to those countries has nothing to do with, they say it's about conflict zones and all
or
that.
Or climate change.
No, exactly. Climate. It's that they've set up agencies, like you just said,
yeah,
to welcome, encourage and welcome refugees to their countries.
Yeah.
It's economic migration. It's not conflict migration.
Now that I think about it, Ireland's number one group is Ukrainians,
mm-hmm,
in the space of a year. And also in the space of that year, the second is Georgians.
Mm-hmm.
That's not coincidence. That's part of their unspoken scheme to integrate the society into the European Union.
Right.
Thus NATO.
Yeah.
Thus against Russia.
Mm-hmm.
To get them used to,
mm-hmm,
how it is over here, to get them, mm-hmm, to like it, to get them to, you know,
to have families,
encourage ties,
familial links, yeah, with the European EU nation. Yeah.
Huh. Breaking news today, just on this theme, because it fits, it's also regional, it's kind of got a double, this hits 2 points of what we're talking about. Can you put that one up for Marty? Helicopter with ex-Soviet states leader, specifically the Armenian Prime Minister, makes emergency landing.
Due to inclement weather.
Again, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia. Which way will Armenia go? Was this just another accident? Is it a message?
Yeah, there's been a bit of a, you know, kind of a, it's funny, yeah. I think there was someone else had to make an emergency landing. There's something else in the past few days, some other politicians. It's kind of interesting just to notice the, you know, the a confluence of, or a concurrence of events like that, you know, after, you know, well, obviously after the Iranian president and foreign minister, et cetera, and then and Vico getting shot and not killed, but shot, and then politicians having, you know, having scary moments, let's say, where their personal safety is compromised in one way or another. You know, it's weird to see the confluence in that. And the other weird thing to see that we missed, I suppose, was that just since we're on that topic, it's kind of like off topic, but it's also on topic in a strange way. It was that flight from London to Singapore, I think, with the turbulence.
Yeah. Where the plane fell, like
6,000 feet or something, 6,000 metres or 6,000 feet, one or the other. Anyway, in a very short period of time, and one guy was killed, although he supposedly died of a heart attack, but a lot of people seriously injured because not wearing their seatbelts. But that's something, like, turbulence is on the increase, and it's obviously climate change, right? Global warming's doing that. So
here we are bringing in an X factor, so yeah, to speak, where the confluence of things need not all be political conspiracies.
No, exactly. Or national security, exactly.
Strategic, it's, blah, blah.
It can get harder and harder to pick it out, sort it out, you know, yeah. When the weather starts interfering in weird ways. But there was this is one just from, this is super breaking news. 12 people injured on a flight during turbulence. Or injured during turbulence on a flight from Dublin to, or from Doha in Qatar to Dublin. 6 passengers and 6 crew members were injured in the incident. The turbulence was experienced while flying over Turkey this time. Yeah, the one previous one during the week there was, it was over Thailand. They're flying to Singapore, and it was over Thai airspace, I think.
And was it from Dublin? That
was from London. London to Singapore, and this one was Doha to Dublin, and over Turkey. And interestingly, you'd wonder why, if you look at a map, you know, you see, I suppose it would go over Turkey, yeah. I was thinking they do avoid Ukrainian airspace, yeah. But it was over Turkey that they had the turbulence. So, yeah. And that's, yeah, it's getting more and more dangerous to fly. I mean, of course, it's still relatively safe to fly. You know, you can't get spooked by one or two incidents like this and decide you're never going to fly again, because every flight's going to get turbulence and people are going to get injured.
Statistically, you're still grand.
Yes.
But
the statistics, it's getting less and less.
The statistics are, yeah.
The chances are getting higher and higher, but still very, very low. What's most interesting about it is just the change in the climate and change in weather patterns and change in severe weather. Affecting aircraft, you know, it's amazing that it doesn't happen more often. Like, you could make the argument that, well, listen, if there really is a significant change in severe weather, like the extent that we should get worried about it, then planes should be having these problems all the time, because there's thousands and thousands of planes flying through the air and across the globe every single day.
Yeah.
So if there's major worldwide global weather pattern changes, then planes would be the first to experience them, you know, and they are. But it's just,
especially if they're Boeing.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, they are, but it's...
That's a man-made issue, though.
But it's also a big planet, you know what I mean? Yeah. So,
and
the fact that we
notice
it...
symbolically, turbulence, Dublin, well, again, it's hard to say how much turbulence that is, but the protest movement against mass migration, that's a lot of turbulence. At least, maybe not in the city, but in rural Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Come back to Slovakia. We've already mentioned that it looked cut and dried. A lefty nutter, he was arrested. He's on tape, quickly shared by the police in Slovakia, as saying, I didn't like his policies. Okay, you're going to shoot him? Destroy your life?
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit more going on there, I think. People have commented on the shit response of his security. I'm not able to comment on that. They should have been there quicker. They should have gone in front before he approached the crowd. Don't know. But like I said, the most telling thing so far is suspicion from the government, which they have divulged
mm-hmm.
as to how his social media accounts were wiped within 2 hours.
Who wiped them, yeah. His handlers.
Fico, why Fico? Well, I think that's fairly obvious. He's only recently elected, late last year, but he has been a vocal opponent against the Ukraine war,
mm-hmm.
Like Orban.
Mm-hmm.
He's all for aid to Ukraine, but where aid is not, you know, HIMARS.
And this, we didn't finish on that EU commissioner guy that was in Georgia, wasn't it? Yeah, it was Georgia. But he referred to Fico, and so you could assume that he meant, what he claims he meant was that, look, if you don't give the people what they want, this is what can happen. You just get some crazy guy. So the EU commissioner who made that comment to him was just an idiot, obviously, or either he was trying to drop a subtle hint and he's pretty Machiavellian, or he's just an idiot and
goes and
thinks that Fico was just shot by some random guy who didn't like him because of his policies. Because, like, you know, the people, EU commissioners are in this bubble, right?
He's going to believe that everyone is vying for entry into the EU.
Right, exactly.
And if they don't get it, they might
get angry. Yeah. But he took it as a... It also could be interpreted as a, if you don't play along politically with this, then we will have you shot by some lone wolf dude.
Let's have a closer look at this, because if he's an idiot, he's a cunning one. He's a bit cunning. You've noticed his name was probably Eastern, probably Baltic origin or whatever, and he's the EU commissioner for enlargement. And in this time, what is the EU still pushing east for? Obviously, this is all dovetailed with NATO. At this point, the whole lie or the whole pretense that the EU and NATO was separate is horseshit. One is for the other. One is soft power for the other. So the specific things that the Georgian prime minister said were that the EU commissioner told him that he could end up suffering the same fate as Fico. Kobakhizde said that the unnamed, well, we since know who he is, Oliver Varelli, warned Georgian prime minister during a phone call that the West would take, quote, a number of measures against him if the government pressed ahead with the law requiring foreign NGOs in Georgia to disclose their funding. So right there, he is coming with a fucking threat. There's a threat baked into the other statement. While listing these measures, he mentioned, you see what happened to Fico, and you should be very careful. I mean, that's pretty clear.
A number of measures would be taken against him if he didn't back out of this law, and then mentioned Fico, which is that one of those measures?
Right.
Yeah, obviously, if you didn't want to be misinterpreted or misunderstood, you wouldn't say that at all, right? But that's not how these people play. It's thuggery. It's mafia type stuff.
It is thuggery. And what they maybe didn't expect was that he would divulge the contents of the phone call, because at that level, you don't generally do that. This guy's either, is he brave? Is he naive? I don't know. He may be naive.
Mm-hmm.
I do fear for him, actually, because he's put himself front and center now.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, you're not just arguing with dry bureaucrats from Brussels. That's the power of NATO and the CIA and MI6. We've left the EU. Oh, a Ukraine war has started against Russia. We've left the EU, my arse. NATO is still front and center for London. So they may as well, like we said at the time, Brexit won't mean Brexit. Mm-hmm. And look what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
So he's up against, a lot of power right now. That's why I'm thinking just save yourself, if nothing else, and at least talk quietly to Moscow.
Right.
Maybe if you don't want to make a big scene about it, do it quietly. For the moment, he's relying on sunlight being the best disinfectant and just talking about it publicly. But he's going to need more than that.
Yeah. Yes. Did you mention the ex-Soviet, did you say the Armenian Prime Minister's helicopter?
Yeah. He's alive.
How to make that?
That really was an emergency landing. Mm-hmm. But who knows? It can still be a message. There have been emergency landings in the past that were I think Merkel had to do it, one or two. Anyway. Yeah, that's... I don't know where we want to go next. The next on my list is the UK is called snap election. Snap elections?
Yeah.
Well, they were due anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2019. Could have been next year, whatever.
They should eventually keep up the appearance of democracy by letting people vote for the Prime Minister rather than just appointing them, you know?
Well, they've had six Prime Ministers and five Prime Ministers in 8 years.
The last three have been appointed rather than voted for by the population.
Normally, this next clip I want to show would be like satire or someone has done something to alter it to make fun of the situation. But what you're actually going to watch is 30 seconds of the British selected Prime Minister Rishi Sunak announcing the elections. And this is how it actually aired on the BBC.
Major milestones in delivering that stability, showing that when we work together, anything is possible. Our economy is now growing faster than anyone predicted, outpacing Germany, France, and the United States. And this morning it was confirmed that inflation is back to normal. This means that the pressure on prices will ease and mortgage rates will come down. This is proof that the plan and priorities I set out are working. I recognise that it has not always been easy. Some of you will only just be starting to feel the benefits. And for some, it might still be hard when you look at your bank balance. But this hard-earned economic stability was only ever meant to be...
Okay. Right. Most people aren't going to get it because it's hard to hear. But if you're thinking, was that a Muslim call to prayer at 10 Downing Street? No, it wasn't. That was D. Reams, things are only going to get better.
Things can only get better, yeah.
Blaring in the background. You kind of need to be British and to be a bit older to remember that was what Tony Blair's New Labour team had blaring in the background as one of their themes.
Well, it still is officially the Labour's anthem.
Is
the Labour Party's anthem, yeah. I think that's why someone was playing it.
Ah, you think someone was hijacking his moment.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't meant to be played by his cabinet.
No.
That wasn't his people doing it.
No.
Oh, okay, so he was trolled. Right.
You can tell it's from a distance away. It was probably outside the gates of 10 Downing Street type thing, and someone decided just to set up a... And they didn't get in top of it in time.
What's up with his suit? It was pouring rain.
Mm.
Normally someone's there with an umbrella or they've enclosed it, but something happened and it was such a hurry that he had to say it, or the rain came on unexpectedly. That's why his suit is drenching wet. However, in later clips that were aired on the evening news, they'd been doctored to show that his suit was fine. They removed the drenched look. So anyway, yeah. I don't know. I'll defer to a British MP, probably one of the few, like Galloway, who's actually a proper MP in that he's looking after constituents' interests. You remember this guy, Andrew Bridgen? He spoke out about COVID and vaccines in Parliament. And then was kicked out of the Conservative Party, although he remains an MP, of course, because he was elected by the people. He's asked on this podcast.
That was the same tweet.
Oh, was it?
Wrong link.
God dang, what happened? No, I'm not going to be able to find it then. So, anyway, Andrew Bridgen reckons... And he was asked it before this announcement was made, that Sunak, quote, doesn't want to be a war PM, wartime Prime Minister. So he would call it soon. And he was right, it's been called. I.e. hot war with Russia. He said this, hot war with Russia in some form. An increase, a drastic escalation is coming this summer. And they need an election beforehand. Now, I couldn't work out politically how that fits with specific, like, internal Tory needs for a mandate.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there's a whole separate other argument that is that Rishi Sunak was just a placeholder for a new Labour government, a new Labour government mm-hmm. with Keir Starmer. Whatever's going on in London domestically, though, what do you think? Is there other geopolitical interest considerations that are more important here? Is it about something like something that's coming this summer, something they think that's coming? They want the mandate
mm-hmm.
for it. Oh, here's a bit before I pass it to you. This is something I definitely have because I didn't mess up any links here because I have a screenshot of the Financial Times today announcing or just simply reporting Rishi Sunak's first announcement of what he would do as Prime Minister. Number one on his list.
Rishi Sunak?
Yeah.
If he gets to be Prime
Minister. Here it is here. Rishi Sunak vows to reintroduce UK National Service in first major campaign policy. Now, I know this has been happening in Germany, or it's been bruited in Germany. France, Macron wants to reintroduce it. And to be clear, National Service, I read an interpretation of it that it would be conscription, but I'm not sure. I don't know what National Service of old was like in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can Google it now. What do they mean by that? Is it just like it used to be in some countries in Europe, you know, your first 2 years after you leave school must have some kind of military service and off you go, carry on? Or is it more like compulsory military training?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's something I think that backs up what Bridgen was getting at. That the primary consideration for timing here and for arranging the next government in London
mm-hmm.
is with this in mind, like mm-hmm. a sea change coming up,
possibly. But I mean, what could they be expecting or anticipating? Some kind of a hot war, like you said, a hot war with Russia. But like that's not going to happen. So
the movement of NATO troops, uniforms. Mm. No longer like pretending to be part of the Georgian Foreign Legion, actually wearing the flag on the shoulders into Western Ukraine.
Yeah, just to occupy it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they're anticipating.
And thus testing whether or not Russia would send in a kinjal.
Yeah, it could get dicey in a certain sense, but, you know, but we've been anticipating that for quite a long time, that ultimately, you know, Ukraine would be divided as countries, strategically important countries have been between great powers over the past, you know, several hundred years. You know, it's nothing new under the sun in that respect. But it seems like it's a good idea to have a general election in the UK now too, so they can at least say that whichever prime minister is leading the government in such a situation has popular mandate, that the prime minister himself has popular mandate in a sense, because obviously, like we said, the last three prime ministers in the Conservative Party were all elected, as each one skipped out. So we started with Liz Truss, and then she was booted, and then you had Boris back in, and then he decided to leave, and then you had Rishi. Oh no, sorry, I'm thinking of Theresa May. Theresa May was elected though, in a general election. I'm pretty sure she was elected. So then she left, and
Boris was too though.
There was no general election.
I think he won head to head against Corbyn, 2019.
No, 2019. That's too far back. Liz Truss
then came after Boris.
Okay, so it was
left
Boris
under weird circumstances.
Okay, so it was Boris was elected then.
Liz Truss lasted 20 days, and then Sunak.
No, after between Liz Truss and Sunak there was.
That's it.
Are you sure?
Yeah. It starts with Cameron. He ends 2016.
No, but that's.
Then okay. Boris, after Brexit, cock-up. Boris, excuse me, Theresa May. Cameron, Theresa May. She's the shoe-in for the end of Cameron's term because he had to flee because he said he would leave if it was a yes vote. But she gets, I think, They can't both win, can they?
Who?
Theresa May and Boris actually won in the general election. I'm not sure. No. May did. I think Boris did. Head-to-head against Corbyn. One of them did win, actually, properly, the general election, where they were the leader of the Conservative Party. But there have been two shoe-ins since then, at least. Truss and then Sunak. And, you know, in hindsight, like, Liz Truss, she would at least have been more, she would still have been very pro-NATO, but she was a bit more reality-based. Compared with Sunak is the consummate politician. It's just boilerplate. Hi. And there's nothing real behind it. He himself he's not a billionaire, but he's married to a billionaire, an heiress or something. Mm-hmm. He's an oligarch, outright, you know. Rich Tory boy.
Okay. So, yeah. So the UK was having, 24th of July was when Boris won. In 24th of July 2019, Boris won, and then he left and all that kind of stuff.
He left because of the COVID? Because of his behaviour, right, exactly, during lockdowns and stuff?
So he was out then. So that was 2019. So it's for a five-year term. So general election was scheduled this year anyway.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
5 years will have been up on the 24th of July, this year, 24th of July this year.
Well, then that's much simpler. They just did it because they have to.
Yeah.
They have to. They have to keep up the pretense. They probably look forward to the day when they don't have to. Because, FYI, Ukraine has just passed the end of Zelensky's term. Mm-hmm. He is now ruling by fiat. Technically, he doesn't rule a shit, but he's coked up the wazoo. But he is technically the dictator, as the classical meaning of that term from ancient Rome. Zelensky is now the dictator of Ukraine because he's supposed to be gone. Constitutionally, he's left. The mandate, it's over.
Yep. Yeah, this year, maybe they're talking about, they're talking now about, last year it was Ukraine's super awesome offensive, best offensive ever, and that didn't happen. And this year, now it's Russia that's going to supposedly have a new awesome offensive this summer offensive. And there's talk in the news recently of the West, you know, getting desperate or whatever, and starting to potentially considering supplying weapons to Ukraine that they could use to strike inside Russia, like Western weapons, right? Supposedly, attacks on Belgorod, which was one today, actually, have only been done by using quote unquote Ukrainian weapons, but long range Western weapons may be supplied to Ukraine so that Ukraine can attack Russia directly because they're getting desperate. But who knows? It's open up in the air, and the Russians say that would be really bad because then it would, you know, then you would have your direct confrontation. Then you'd have nuclear war, right? Potential nuclear war, or ramping up towards nuclear war if the West gets to, fire missiles anywhere in Russia or well inside Russia via Ukraine.
The scary thing about this is that when they say we're thinking of the next escalation, it's usually already 2 months underway. Mm. What did you make of this? I'm sure you saw it. We don't have to read the whole tweet, but the photos will jog your memory. An attack on the Armavir strategic early warning radar. I don't know where that's located, but I presume this counts as deep Russia. So scroll down for the photos.
I think it was in Voronezh. So not,
this is supposedly Russia's first line in strategic nuclear defense. This is a radar installation, and it's been hit with Ukrainian domes sometime in the last 48 hours. Does that count? Russia has rights.
It's Krasnodar,
to retaliate in kind, no? But then if it's coming from Ukraine, NATO didn't do it.
It's so cynical. At this point, it's like you'd have to look at who fired it and, you know, what kind of weapons did they use? Do they use weapons that are freely available on the open market that Ukraine could have acquired that way? Or are these weapons that only Ukraine could only have acquired from the US or a European nation, and therefore it, you know. But, well, I mean, Russian, various Russian senators, or a few Russian senators, or members of parliament have said that this is, like, there's no way that, I don't know if this is true or not, but they say there's no way that they, this could have been just the Ukrainians doing this, that they, it would have had to been sanctioned by the by the West, or you know, the targeting and the equipment or the missiles required to hit them would have been. But then what were they hit with, you know? Was that a long-range drone? Because here you're talking about Amavir, like I said, it's in the Krasnodar region. It's about, well, from Ukrainian lines, it is pretty far. It's probably
800.
600 kilometers from Ukrainian lines. But, yeah, can you get? They have drones that can fly that distance, yes. Does Ukraine make them themselves? Probably not. You know, so with the drones, Western drones, yes. Does that make it a West? You know, it's just, there's a smoke and mirrors aspect to it, or a fog of war aspect to it, you know.
And a key part of it is, yeah, now we're thinking of beginning to encourage Ukraine to, oh, well, breaking news. But wasn't this? Bullshit.
Yeah, so it all comes down to the, what, like I said, what weapon was used and how serious it is, and whether there's a policy of the West to start doing this or not. And
all this talk of conscription in every NATO country, except the US, but they have a standing army, a vast one. Are they that mad? I know, mad. Mad's a key word here, the operative.
Conscription, all that kind of stuff is, again, you have to, you know, I think you should go for cynicism more than hysterical, we're all going to die in a nuclear conflagration. I would go for the cynical aspect to all these things, because war is very cynical, and the people that run wars are very cynical people. It's not personal, like I've often said. So the conscription and stuff like that is most likely, if it's going to actually happen, if anything comes of it, they can talk all they want about stuff and nothing ever happens often. But if conscription were to happen, or if there was some kind of mobilization, like you were saying earlier on, it's most likely to do with them foreseeing in the near future, i.e. in the next year, or thereabouts, an end, a definitive end to the war in Ukraine, where Ukraine basically can't fight anymore and the West kind of just accepts that and gives up. But they decide to divide Ukraine down the middle. I mean, it would be nice if they had just divided Ukraine down the middle in the first place, you know. However, by the end of this year, it'll be coming up on, 4 years? 4 years of war. I mean,
Two and a half.
Oh, sorry, 2.5 years of war. March 2020. It'll be It's two now plus 2.5. So coming on three, let's say. Sorry, three. Coming up in 3 years of war. If at that point they just decide to divide Ukraine down the middle, then a reasonable question is, why couldn't you have done that at the beginning? You know, why couldn't the obvious belligerent here, Russia and the West, sit down and say, listen, this is where it's going to go. But then neither would have agreed to that, because the war has actually been good for everybody.
Yeah.
And this is, again, it sounds cynical, well, but less it's true.
Russians.
Well, it's been very good for Russia as a country, in general. That's always a calculation. The Russians are and have benefited from, economically, in terms of international standing, etc., from this conflict. If it has to happen, you know, then okay, war isn't the worst case scenario for from many different perspectives. You know? Obviously, the West is happy to go to war because they get to get rid of all their old stock, and they get ultimately in the end result may be that they get to get half of Ukraine for Europe.
If that happens, I will. Yeah, I'll be resigned to it. But my God. I saw a clip from Claire Daly and her sidekick, forget his name, the other Irish
Harry Mann.
MEP.
Harry Wolfman.
They were interviewed by Glenn Deason and Alexander McCourse. There's just a clip, but they said they've been looking at some of the facts and figures about land ownership in Western Ukraine since the war started. It's already notorious that, you know, for donkey's years, because of IMF funds and structural adjustment loans, Ukraine basically sold off a lot of what it had. Mm-hmm. But when the war started, your Black Rocks and your Blackstones and your Cargills and the American major companies, they went apeshit. They've been buying up land, like, to the point they're like, they practically consider themselves the landowners of huge tracts of Western Ukraine. I'm like, well, that's it. This is where their sense of entitlement comes from. When Macron is like, well, now we will send in troops into Western Ukraine. I mean, it is, after all,
ours.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm like. That's why they talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
They really do feel entitled to it.
Yeah. Well, the stark reality is that
we have the deeds.
The stark reality is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're the villains in this picture. Those people in the West, obviously, because you could say that.
Russia's doing.
No, they're entitled to own Ukraine, to own part of Ukraine and see it that way. Because if they hadn't helped Ukraine over the past 2.5 years, Ukraine would be Russian now. Mm. But that's not, it doesn't start there. You can't start the narrative there. The narrative starts before it, where you provoked Russia to start a war in Ukraine. So that then you could use, you know, that conflict to intervene and help Ukraine and take half of the country and then say it's yours. Ukraine would have been fine if it had been left alone by the Western powers. It would have been a quote-unquote independent, well, it would have been an independent country as it has been since 1991, and it would have continued on to be effectively in mostly, you know, within Russia's sphere of influence. But they didn't want to leave it that way. They didn't want to live with that situation. So they decided to try and stir things up. They had their coup in 2014. They tried to bring all of Ukraine into the Western sphere of influence. Russia said no. Russia and they.
But hang on, there's a bigger interest. I agree with all that, vis-a-vis Ukraine itself. But the bigger interest was that the bet they made was that doing all this would hammer Russia.
I don't think
now.
I don't know.
Was that bluff? Did they actually know better? Did they really? Actually, we knew Russia's economy would grow and it would get stronger and the sense of national civic spirit would increase and Russia's innovation and so on would go through the roof. We knew that. But they said at the start, we're bringing Russia to its knees. We're going to sanction the shit out of this country. Verhofstadt was like, here we go. What does Russia not have? Money and access to money systems. Mm-hmm. We're going to crush it. Maybe he seemed to really believe it.
Maybe they lied to themselves, and yeah, I can understand they might have bullshitted themselves in that respect. Or it was unknown. This was a process of discovery, right? Because we've never had this kind of a serious. We haven't seen Russia put itself onto a war economy footing and mobilize in the way it has done. And we suspect that with added pressure from us, it won't be able to do that effectively. There will be all sorts of internal divisions, and it will collapse, and we'll get what we want. But that was a risky bet to take because. You know, historically, most major countries that go to war generally do benefit from it.
Yeah.
You know, especially when they go to war against a country that is smaller than them and they know they can defeat. You know, like the Americans in Iraq, the Americans in pick any number of countries, but like the Brits in the Falkland Islands, you know, Maggie Thatcher and the Conservative Party in the early 1980s.
Yeah,
really boosted the economy and boosted, well-being or something at home by having a little belligerent jaunt down to the South Atlantic to invade to take back the Falklands or protect the Falklands. You know, and there's all sorts of jingoism and national pride. And everybody feels better, and somehow that then the economy feels better because everybody feels better because the economy has a sentiment itself. You know, the economy often feels good or feels bad on any given day. The economy likes jingoism and nationalism as well, and it gets to feel better. Whenever you have a jingoistic war.
And they thought that it would be the opposite in Russia?
But yes, I mean.
With the history of European coalitions going to Russia.
That's why I said it was a risky book. They have this negative view of Russia, but I mean, it's wishful thinking in a certain sense, because like if you have this lens on, these blinkers on, or this filter on in front of your eyes where Russia's evil and Russia must be destroyed, and we are the exceptional part of the world, we're the golden billion,
yeah,
and Russia shouldn't really exist, and it really is just a gas station. one big gas station. We want it to be broken up into various, we want it to be balkanized, therefore it will happen because we're reality creators, right? But if they looked a bit more calmly and coldly at history and they analyzed in that respect and saw that this is a major, you know, the country, it's a 4-to-1 ratio in terms of population and even much more than that in terms of wealth and natural resources, you would say that, well, ultimately, you know, obviously Ukraine is not going to win a war against Russia. Russia is going to emerge victorious, and any country that emerges victorious from a war nearly always benefits.
But they didn't say that. They didn't look
because we will be able to
It's history 101. Yeah. You go to Russia and no, this doesn't happen. So what is it? It's wishful thinking. It's their hubris is so strong, the egocentric belief that, of course, it's self-evident that we're going to win here, yeah, one way or the other.
Well, if you live in a bubble and you chuck Russia down all the time and call it all sorts of names and say it's just you know, it's very little different from the Russia, the
Soviet Union.
The Russia of the 1990s, you know, the corrupt,
yeah,
you know, kind of almost failed state.
The mafia state.
Mafia state,
they call it.
You know, Putin's just put on a show for the past 20 years, but behind the scenes, it's just as corrupt as it ever was.
It's
basically
a Potemkin front.
Yeah, it'll just fall apart when it's put under some pressure. And they're finding out that that's not the case. And then what do they do? Well, then they're stuck and they don't know what to do. And that's where it gets dangerous. Do they back down? Or do they just fly further into wishful thinking and come up with the next madcap scheme that's going to get them what they want?
We're still on that track. Yeah. That's why hot war is still
talked about.
The next thing, or not the next thing, but it's still, we're on the trend for that still,
yeah,
you know? So they haven't changed course. There's been no real reality check. Now and again, there's a hint of it. You know,
an example of it is this, just of what we're saying, is this lady, what's her name? Estonian, I think, foreign minister. She's a bit of a harpy.
Okay, callous.
Yes. Listen to her.
Russia's defeat is not a bad thing because then, you know, there could be really a change in the society. And you know, there are many different nations right now, part of Russia as well. I think if you would have more like small nations, it's not a bad thing if the big power is actually much smaller. So
I just read that in a pamphlet handed to me by from Washington. It's the 101, Russia needs to be balkanized because it's become many different nations, and it should be different, many different nations, and therefore much smaller and much more and wouldn't be such a big threat to us, and
she's smiling.
Yeah, it's happy. I'm happy. The big power should be smaller. She said, now children, the big power should be smaller. The big power we don't like should be smaller. How do we make the big power smaller?
By doing whatever it takes to crack it open,
yeah,
and then absorb it into our system. Not necessarily, not Russian style, into the country.
It's manifest destiny, man.
Into the system. The way she's smiling, like, it's, here I am at another think tank, you know. Everyone in the room knows what I'm talking about, and that it's the right thing to do, obviously, hence I can smirk about it.
Yeah.
But the implications of what she's saying, the trend we're on of what she's saying is fucking nuclear war. I know it's still not likely to happen, but she's smiling in the face of it.
Yeah. But we can do it without having our nuclear war, you see. We can do the revolutions, the color revolutions, the revolutions with
Macron's just going to send his French Foreign Legion.
We're going to send the transgender people into Russia.
Can you put up, did you get the one I sent at the same time? So now and then there's a reality check. And I know this is RT, but it's not really. It's them commenting on a big spread in the Washington Post, which I didn't have time to actually get the original link for. But I saw the headline. Washington Post had a reality check on what's been happening. This is a 180 on the entire characterization of Russian shovels and conscripts and what is it when the meat grinder approach? You just throw bodies at the bullets and they absorb them. This is how Russia's, you know, still in the war. Turns out they're now informing people, at least in the Beltway across the Atlantic, that basically every additional piece of high-tech equipment that's gifted to Ukraine and fired by the CIA type spooks, but whatever, and at targets either in the front line proper or over the heads and at civilian targets in Russia. Russia bests. They maybe get one or two uses out of them and then they can counter them. Let me see. Let's read from the beginning. Many U.S.-made munitions that rely on satellite guidance have failed to withstand Russia's jamming technology after a supply to Kiev. They just have to stop using them. Those gifts are just sitting in warehouses. They're useless now. And it's one thing listed after the other by Washington Post. HIMARS, JDAM.
Excalibur.
Excalibur. I also read that the Atacam stuff, you get to use something, but then Russia has the capacity to neutralize its effectiveness. And that's been the case every day for the last 2 years. You know, and then, so I suppose this, what I'm getting is this, this is, that's sort of maybe a military reality check, an insight that they're not going to win this thing, right? There is no, this trending scenario where we eventually break Russia up is such a load of horseshit.
Yep. So let's just, the cynical take would say that we'll just settle for half of Ukraine. Look at it beforehand, before the war, right?
Yeah.
All of Ukraine was in America's, in Russia's sphere of influence. After the war, 50% of it is de facto owned by us. How is that not a win? Sure, Russia, you know, it's a win-win in a certain sense. Russia improves economically, etc., and internationally and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, we get something that we wouldn't have had beforehand.
You're assuming that Russia's going to accept
they probably will.
A Korean settlement.
They probably will.
Well, you need a DMZ. Yeah. I mean, one that they can't fire over.
Plenty of precincts, and everybody can shake hands and say, good game.
Kiev, maybe. Kiev region and the Dnieper would be DMZ, neutral territory.
Well, yeah, a little bit.
You'd have to form a separate statelet.
A few kilometres like of kind of DMZ line, whatever. Like, you
know. Oh, no, I'm thinking more like somewhere that they can't keep firing back at.
No, but...
After their order to stop firing.
No, obviously,
yeah.
It's all done.
It's done.
And we just split the country. We're talking about a peace settlement.
Okay.
Here, right? We get half of Ukraine. You get the other half. We all shake hands and say good game.
But if the other half is NATO installed weaponry on an ongoing basis, Russia's back to square one on NATO on its doorstep.
Well, NATO's on its doorstep anyway. Just don't want it right on its doorstep in terms of especially in that particular region. I mean, they've got NATO, they've got Finland, Sweden now, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. Estonia and Latvia. Right on its border. Finland's obviously on its border. Lithuania's in the border of Belarus. But now if you keep them back along the Dnieper, then it's not on Russia's border. And that's just the way it goes, you know. That's what they've been doing all along. So, but at least they're not right on our southern border. It's one thing to have to deal with them on our eastern border, like on our northeastern border along the Baltics. But we don't want them, we want all of Ukraine as a NATO state. Because that obviously we lose Crimea, and then they're right there on our southern border, southeastern border, and on our right along. At that point, it's just too much, you know. That's too much. So we're not doing that. We can live with the Baltics, but we're not doing Ukraine. We're not having a kind of semi-circle surround us.
Yeah,
it's
not the principle of the thing. Ukraine was specific because they had turned it into something with which attack and provoke Russia into doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not simply the principle that we won't allow NATO anything on our border. Ukraine was more specific. It was a specific context. Just to complement the Washington Post report that the Russians have always, at every turn, bested them or at least neutralized or very quickly outmaneuvered the best military tech that the West has offered Ukraine. He says at some meeting yesterday, RT has a write-up, we must stay a step ahead of the enemy, i.e. specifically, Russia must always be one step ahead and he's in order to guarantee victory. Mm-hmm. He's congratulating them on having done so far, and let's keep this up and we'll be fine. So there's that quiet confidence in Moscow that they have been one step ahead throughout this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a 180 inversion of the Western interpretation of how this war has gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's
because behind the scenes they understood it from the perspective that they understand it from that perspective that I mentioned earlier, which is that this is all on a continuum. You know, what's happening now? Each generation thinks that they live. You know, they're the only ones who've ever been alive, type thing. What's happening in their time is the first time it's ever happened. But this kind of great game you know, there's a strong argument to say that, you know, this conflict between Russia and the West goes back hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been, like, you know, they coined the term the Great Game, and, you know, the struggle for Africa and all that kind of stuff, you know, takes it into Africa and stuff. But in terms of Ukraine and Crimea, the Crimean War, you go back to the Crimean mm-hmm. War.
To prevent Russian access to the Mediterranean with their naval fleets.
They've been doing this for hundreds of years, and they're just doing the same thing. So if any Russian...
Brzezinski saying,
yeah,
whoever controls... Well, not Brzezinski. In fact, Brzezinski was lip-syncing Mackinder.
Yeah.
British...
Alfred Mackinder.
British Alfred Mackinder in, like, late... around the turn of the century, in 1900.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He who controls the heartland controls Eurasia. And the heartland he had in mind was what we call today the Ukraine.
Yeah. The heartland, yeah. But also you can go back to, you know, in more recent times, Afghanistan was part of the Great Game conflict with the Soviet Union, and that had its history as well. All of it is on a continuum. And
yeah.
So any politicians in Russia or in the West who see it, and I assume they do see it, a lot of them do see it from that perspective, think that this is
just life on Earth.
This is business as usual. And you... having that history of 300 years of seeing how they go about it, albeit updated for the modern era and all that kind of stuff, with the question of the dangerous aspect, the new and dangerous aspect of nuclear war, which is talked about a lot in terms of, you know, things are different from the way they were a few hundred years ago when there were no nuclear weapons. So we have to keep an eye on that and make sure that doesn't get out of control. But assuming everybody's on board with that, then let's just play this out like it has played out in centuries gone by, where this is ultimately about... you know, having the war, there's no choice, you know, that's the way it works, I think, apparently. And yeah, there's a lot of blame to be laid at the doorstep of the West and Washington and stuff for being a bunch of exceptionalist, manifest destiny, we rule the world, that kind of thing, and not playing fair, not being able to shift into a more multipolar mindset. They can't do that, so you have to end up going to war with them because they're not going to stop. They're going to try and attack you and take you down. It's kind of like someone who thinks there should be no war is like... I don't know what sport I'd pick, you know, like soccer, football, whatever, any sport where you go onto the field and you think, you know, the other team should help you or should pass the ball to you or should not score a goal against you, you know what I mean? You go onto the field...
Let's not all be so aggressive.
Yeah, let's be nice.
Let's take out yoga mats instead and do yoga together.
Yeah, yeah. Let's not have a competition here, you know. Let's not be... And let's not fight, you know. Let's not have a competition and fight over this stuff, you know, but it's like... that's not the way it works. That's not the way life has ever gone down on this planet. And people have had a long time to accept that's the situation.
You know, of course, there's another subtext to it. I put on that Western outlook hat to try and understand where they're coming from.
Mm.
And you occasionally get it, like from Callas there, the Estonian PM.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe she denies she ever said it, Madeleine Albright in the 90s.
Mm.
It's like... Oh, someone I saw today, actually, Maggie Thatcher complained about it back in the 80s. Russia is so big, and they have everything. Diamond, gold, oil, gas, land, trees. It's like, just share the resources. And why not? And then I put my head, you know, put yourself in the Russian government shoes. What is the big deal? Why don't we just forego all this stuff and just let them, you know.
Mm.
But... there is something they're resisting.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes beyond geopolitics.
Yes,
because there's wokery, there's ideology, there's cohesiveness of what? Well, we're not sure. Russia's not simple. You can't just say, oh, it's an ethno-nationalist state, Russia, and it's a Slavic thing.
Because
Russia's complex. It's got a huge Muslim majority, minority population. People see all the different ethnicities to fight in their army for the Russian flag. But... Its unity is not racial. It's something else.
Yeah.
What do they refer to? Every year, it's their most sacred holiday. They just did it again, May 9th, World War II.
Mm-hmm.
That did something to them, if nothing else before that. It depends where you start. But that did something. That was existential.
Mm-hmm.
And all the people in that part of the world came together, and against the odds, they resisted the Nazis. And there's this resistance to, you know what? No, I could just go with the flow and let in your NGOs, let in your bankers, let in your CIA advisors. That's what Russia tried that in the 90s. Mm-hmm. They gave it a real shot. They said, fine, we'll drop all of it. Come on in. Take what you want. And it was so devastating that it gave birth to the resistance that came in the form eventually of some patriots who helped Putin get in.
Yep.
And here we are.
Yeah, there's definitely that aspect to it as well, you know. That's kind of, I mean, when you go to war, if somebody goes to war against you, it's almost like, by definition, you're not just going to sit back and roll over, you know. If someone wants to take over your country by hook or by crook, by one way or another, wants to invade your country and take it over, because by definition, they're going to steal your resources. They may enslave your people. This goes back, you know, for all of human history.
Yeah.
It's not a good idea to just let some other roll into your country or into your town or into your village or whatever and take your stuff, you know. If they want to come in and be friends and trade and all that kind of stuff, fine. But if they want to come in with a domineering, aggressive attitude, then you are duty-bound just by nature to resist it, right? Because you know nothing good is going to come out of it. So that's why there's always been, you know, wars in that sense where you have someone wants to take someone else's stuff, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, there is that added element today. Like in the past, you have all those elements of not wanting to let the invader come in because they will maybe enslave you or they'll take your resources and all that kind of stuff. But there's an added element today of the ideology that comes along with them, which is very pernicious, you know. It's anti-human ideology, which is new, you know what I mean? In the past, you know, when the Brits invaded France,
yeah,
they would have taken France, they would have taken resources and all that kind of stuff. But eventually, after a while, you assume things would have settled down and maybe the French would have started speaking English and stuff, but there wouldn't have been much difference to, they wouldn't have, like, you know, destroyed their churches or you know, destroyed their culture, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a commonality or enough of a similarity or a closeness between those cultures that an Englishman would recognise French culture and a Frenchman recognises English culture in the foundations, you know, and the same across Europe, you know.
But there's an anti-cultural...
Yeah.
There's a drive behind all this.
To destroy the things that are less tangible things, not just your resources and your towns, whatever, but to destroy the other things that, you know, make life that are as valuable in terms of making life worth living, which is your perspective in terms of how you relate to other people and how you see other people.
Your tradition and meanings.
Tradition, meanings, yes. So that's at stake as well. So there's even more reason today for a country like Russia to resist Western intrusions. And any country that has any sense would do that because of the way they're going. So it's reached a peak of I think you could call it evil if you want, but anti-humanism in a certain sense, or dystopian... dystopian human value system. It's reaching a peak of that, you know. So yeah, definitely resist that bullshit.
Meanwhile, in the actual war in Ukraine, Russians advancing across the entire front.
Hmm.
Since we were last doing a show, the Kharkov front opened. It's not clear that, you know, they've come over the border and there's some resources behind them, but they don't seem to be like poised to try and take the city.
No.
In fact, let's just take them at their word. The rationale, as stated, is that we're sick of the rockets coming in and targeting Belgorod and the region around it, civilian targets.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to push.
Yeah. So it's a real...
out of firing range, and that's what they're doing. That's what they say they're doing.
Yeah, it's not a feint in Kharkiv, like, because they obviously they've amassed maybe 40, 50,000 troops and all that kind of stuff. It's not a feint. They are actually going to...
push them back out of firing range to protect Belgorod.
Well, by doing that, yes, that's the ultimate goal. I mean, it's not imminent or anything like that, or in the very near future, but there seems to be a plan to do that. But by doing that, they're pulling troops away from the front line along the long front line, let's say. They've extended the front line and they're pulling Ukrainian troops
away
from the smaller villages and sound along the front line, along Donetsk and stuff, which makes it much easier for Russians then to actually take those towns and take them more quickly.
That's collapsing fast. Apparently, after Chasiv Yar, which was kind of the next bulwark behind Avdiivka, that's it as far as serious dug-in fortifications for Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see, but... they basically had two rings of defense, and Chasiv Yar is the last bulwark, at least in the Donetsk sector.
Yeah.
So this could collapse fast. It's certainly picking up pace, like it hasn't happened since the whole thing began.
Yeah. There's heading, there's Kramatorsk and Slovyansk as well, which are two main major towns, and once, you know, that are in that direction, those little towns that are being defended, and once they fall, then Kramatorsk and Slovyansk. Well, it's all pushing. It's all... And people, if you look at a map, you think that's still pretty far from the Dnieper River, like cutting the country in half. But like, you're talking here about attrition, right? Where Ukraine increasingly has less and less troops available to put into the front lines. They've got less and less experienced troops to put. They're having to move their best troops around to different places, you know what I mean? Because they don't have good troops everywhere, right?
Right.
And the West isn't, you know, they want the West to train more quickly, train their whatever conscripts they can beat over the head and drag into a van. They want to train them more quickly, right, to get them up to speed and be able to put them into action.
You know, as of yesterday, Zelensky, the dictator, decreed conscripts.
Yeah.
Convicts.
Convicts.
There you go.
First convicts released, yeah. That's not a good sign, obviously. So it all spells, points to the end, you know, in the near future. Let's give it another year. This time next year, I think the map will look very different. There is a point where there's a collapse, you know. The defensive line actually collapses. You don't have enough troops to actually, and then the Russian army can do what people have been wanting them to do or said they were going to do.
Big arrow moves.
The 3-day taking of Kiev or whatever, three days to... They'll just roll across the countryside because they'll be unopposed, you know. And at that point, then you focus on the bigger cities, like I said, Kramatorsk, Slovyansk and Kharkiv. But at that point, what kind of defences do they actually have left? You know what I mean? Is there a point where the entire Russian or Ukrainian military actually collapses? You know what I mean? Very often there's a point where there's dissent.
Yeah, well, that's...
You know, where it gets to the point
that's part of the Russian strategy.
The conditions are so bad that there is some kind of dissent and some kind of a coup or an ousting and stuff. And obviously the Russian plan for Ukraine would ultimately be some kind of a... you know, I don't know if Kiev would actually be the... Kiev might be a neutral zone as well or something, but... if they take half the country, let's say, then obviously it's a new country, it's Novo Ukraina or something.
Well, no, they have to ditch that name.
Novo Russia. Call the whole thing Novo Russia, and that F can be Old Ukraine or something, or Rump Ukraine, and there'll be a government probably somewhere...
Galicia.
Somewhere over in Lvov or something. And I don't know what happens to Kiev. Maybe divide down. You could do a Berlin on Kiev, like divide down the middle if you want, you know. That doesn't need to work out, but...
It only forestalls the next...
Some kind of reunification, yeah,
and
ultimately. But then you maybe play the waiting game and you go, let's look at Berlin, you know. Berlin was divided for X number of years and then eventually there's reunification when the times change. So let's just put it off 20 years. You know, let's divide Kiev and let's do a Berlin on Kiev. Why not? It worked, right?
Sort of. But by then the West won't be... The West was... all powerful when Berlin fell in their favor after World War II. That's not going to happen this time.
No,
they can defer the problem, but it's going to.
Well, it's perfect because the river runs right down the middle, like the what they call it, the Dnieper runs right down the middle of Kiev. You know, there's no river in the middle. Is there a river in the middle of Berlin? I don't think so.
The Oder.
Does it run down the middle though?
Don't know.
No, it doesn't. No, there's no river down right down like man. There is a river down the middle of Berlin. Actually, you're right. It's the Is it the Oder? No, the Spree. Anyway, but it's a big river down the middle of Kiev, you know, so...
There's a natural divide.
Mm. Yeah, so we'll have to wait and see, but it's just one of those things, you know. I mean, it's all very predictable in terms of how it's going to play out, and that doesn't factor in stuff happening in, particularly in the West, you know what I mean? Like the whole Trump business, what's going on in America. The picture's going to look very different if you have a civil war. They've already had a civil war in Hollywood on the movie screens, right? There was a movie released this year called Civil War, telling people, it was a preview of what the actual civil war would be like on your screen, so you get used to it, you know what I mean? You know how to fight the civil war.
I know, I've seen people saying, oh, this is predictive programming. Well, maybe, but we'll see. It's Alex Garland, so he's made a few.
Yeah. But if something happens along that line in the US, then all bets are off. I mean, in terms of dividing of Ukraine and all that kind of stuff, maybe they'll have to pull their horns in and deal with problems back at home, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And then I'm sure this is part of Russia's game.
Or a big earthquake, who knows? You know, some kind of, I mean, it wouldn't be surprising if you had some major upsets in that respect.
Turbulence, earthquakes,
yeah,
as above, so below. So yeah, both at the social level, our level, and in the environmental level. The European Union, day by day, it rules by fiat, you know, by decree. Democracy be damned. How like that's not going to lead somewhere good. But again, for now, like Americans, most Europeans are still comfortable. Life's still generally good, so the pressure isn't there. But you can see a few steps ahead. It could be.
It's all
farmers' protests die down for now.
Yeah,
we'll see you next winter. We're probably running out of time, but we can't cover a month's worth of news, of course. But just other ongoing things. Gaza, of course. I couldn't believe it. You said he'll never... Well, I don't know if you said he'll never do it. But when he announced in his State of the Union, Biden, that there would be a pier to bring humanitarian aid to Gaza, we scoffed, at the very least. They did it.
No, I know, yeah.
They did it. It cost 300 plus million quid dollars to... They brought it over to Grand Fanfare, rammed it onto the beach, delivered some aid, and a storm wrecked it. Yesterday.
No.
It's gone.
No, it's not.
It floated away.
You're joking. It was delivering humanitarian bombs to the Israeli military.
Well, yeah, was it used for aid or a bomb? Apparently it was chaos. There were some trucks in aid, and people came, and they're desperate. I can't even imagine. It was delivering some aid, and then the people were saying, well, there's also weaponry coming off. That's it, yes. That's what's left of it.
Really?
It broke off and floated away in a storm. I couldn't believe in myself. I thought this guy was maybe looking at something else and it's fake news. There's a news report about it. $320 million U.S. pier collapses in Gaza, drifts to Ashdod, which is up the coastline.
Wow.
The symbology of it's interesting.
That's the global warming did that.
Here comes America to save the day, and it's gone.
Biden wasn't taking...
And, you know, obviously it's a stunt. This is, you know... Here we are going through all this expense and effort to help save the people of Gaza while this is going on. Also from yesterday. Do you have a read like on how... I don't know how often... This happened yesterday. Maybe it was a single strike. I don't think they're like laying waste to refugees, but... This is, as explained in the, if you just read the text a second, an American Paveway laser-guided bomb dropped from an American F-16 piloted by an American-trained Israeli pilot slams into a refugee camp in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that, yeah.
And no, it wasn't their Hamas tunnel.
Sure it was.
So they'll say.
What else was it?
Well, I saw the aftermath. It's tense.
Yeah, with terrorists in them, Neil. Terrorists.
Women and children.
I'll just keep them on edge, you know. Yeah. They don't want to get me started on them and them Israelis.
I know.
I'll say all sorts of things.
I know. But okay, look.
It's self evident. You don't have to look. It should be self evident for everybody.
Any comment on Ireland, Norway and Spain recognising Palestine last week?
A bit late, no?
I know. They made such a grand thing of it, like, oh, aren't we so magnanimous? But loads of countries have before now. Something like 130. I suppose what's different is two of these are NATO and one's EU.
Mm-hmm.
So it is kind of like a... It certainly pisses Israel off, no end, to see... Betrayal by Western countries, you know. And the Israelis, well, they hauled in the three ambassadors for a teaching moment, made them sit down with press there in the room. And before anyone said anything, did you see that? They just start playing footage of, it's footage that's been going around lately. Again, it's actually from October 7th, of women being mistreated and being abused, verbally at least, by the Hamas captors. But that's already been fact-checked ages ago by the Grey Zone guys. They said they're not civilians. They were taken from the Israeli base at that crossing, the crossing in the north of Gaza. So they immediately played it, you know. It was supposed to be like, and there was two screens, one in front of them, one behind, and they're supposed to be humiliated. And how can you recognize Palestine? Look, October 7th, October 7th. Anyway, it's outrageous. At least in the world of diplomacy, it's just not done, that kind of thing. You might, like, Russia or whoever calls in an ambassador, and behind closed doors, they can say all kinds of things and show them all kinds of things. But you don't do it with the press there as well. It's just like a humiliation ritual, you know? The Israeli, it's not just Israel, of course. There's a, let's say the international Jewish reaction to it is, wow. I don't know who this guy is. He's some important person, I suppose. David Goldman is a Spengler columnist for Asia Times. Claremont Institute. Okay, Washington Fellow. So he's big Beltway Jew. And look what it inspired him to write. The announcement that Spain, for example, would be now recognizing Palestine as a state. He asked, why does Spain recognize, quote unquote, Palestine? The Spanish have never forgiven the Jews. The Jews, all Jews, for 1492, when the Catholic monarchs gave the Jews the choice of exile or conversion. Half of Spain's 200,000 to 300,000 Jews stayed and converted and got their revenge from inside Spanish culture. De Rojas' Celestina, Tirso's Don Juan play, and the Cervantes' Don Quixote were covert Jewish critiques of the Spanish character. The Spanish can't look into the mirror of their culture without seeing a Jew laughing at their silly pretensions. There's a lot to unpack there, but just at one level, he's giving succor to the conspiracy theory that Jews, as a general grouping of people, are Machiavellian and deliberate destroyers of culture and perverters and subverters. Am I reading that? Is that one valid interpretation of what he's saying?
And got the revenge from inside Spanish culture. Okay, so yeah, he's basically saying that the Spanish today, every Spanish person today or Spanish government today is still pissed at the conversos or the
Muranos,
or the Jews that converted and stayed in Spain rather than be expelled.
And they chose to stay because they wanted revenge.
And when they chose to stay, then they started writing some plays and books that made fun of, in a subtle, covert way, made fun of the Spanish character. And that's why today the Spanish government is recognizing Palestine, to get back at the Jews for writing subtle character takedowns in the, you know, 17th century.
It's
that's the Jewish mind. That's the great Jewish mind.
It's a fascinating insight into the Jewish
Jordan
mindset.
Peterson says that Jews are very, very smart.
Yeah.
There's an example of it.
It's Baroque. It's totally illogical. It's fucked up. There's nothing good about it at all. But I suppose it's cultured. He's aware of
some stuff.
Spanish culture. That's cool. Yeah. It's insane. It's fascinating insight, but into the Jewish mindset. He thinks it's fascinating insight into the Spanish.
Yeah. It's, yeah. Well, that's what happens, you know, with those kind of people.
Oh, my God.
They expose themselves in the end. And by thinking they're taking down everybody else, and they expose themselves, and then they're left wondering. Till their dying day, they'll be left wondering why why they don't do what we want them to do. Those piers, but actually the pier didn't wash away. It's a pier and there are several vessels, like small boats, decent-sized boats, whatever, that hold the pier kind of in place. And it was those vessels that got washed away, not the pier itself. I mean, apparently the pier continues to operate, whatever, because they brought in new vessels or something, but the pier itself hasn't washed away.
Well, in that footage, there's nothing there.
Well, that footage didn't show you all of the...
Okay.
What was going on. Yes, because I'm pretty sure if the whole thing had washed away, it would have got some attention, but it's just been presented as a kind of a minor setback, and operations will continue. Here's Times of Israel, which is on the ground, on point. US naval vessels disconnect from Gaza aid pier and wash up on Israeli bases. CENTCOM reports no casualty, says humanitarian jetty is still functioning after four ships break off their moorings.
Okay.
So American vessels connected to a floating pier near the Gaza Strip disconnected Saturday from the jetty due to stormy seas, leading them to get stuck off on the coast of Israel. So four vessels broke free of their moorings. So whatever way they have it set up, it's like they have boats kind of
that
keeping it in place.
Basically are permanently acting as tugs.
Yes.
Keeping it.
Yeah.
Right.
More or less. Probably something like that.
Still, not a good start, no?
No.
But and it's interesting, the weather's in play. They didn't expect storms.
Mm.
They planned for it to be fine from now till September when they'll have to close. Because storms typically come back then.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a sign, another sign of the times, no?
Yeah.
You know, the X factor of the weather.
Yeah.
I have something to say on weather, but can you put up the last one, the Daily Beast? We'll do some a quick little bit of royal watching.
Oh, your favorite topic.
I just think this, well, it doesn't contradict what we were saying before. Kate Middleton may not appear in public for the rest of the year.
She won't.
She's either dead or she's in a coma. Probably in a coma.
Huh? Why?
Well, whatever happened to her, maybe they had to, because that's why she can't make a public appearance.
It's probably a vaccine injury.
Yeah, what kind, though?
Bell's palsy.
Neurological damage. That can be severe, like...
Droopy eye.
Okay, so she's...
Okay. It doesn't have to be serious for her not to be... The average person could carry on with her life, albeit with restrictions, but not a member of the royal family because, you know, there's too many people out there who would start talking about being vaccine injury.
Anyway, it's not cancer.
Probably not, no.
No. Yeah.
Probably not, no, because was cancer...
Look, they can't even put a recent photo of her up. Yeah. They have to just make up some graphic.
If it was cancer, I mean, they could opt to, but maybe it's all a bit obtuse and, you know, I mean, it's all convoluted. The whole royal aspect in the UK is very peculiar, you know what I mean? Like, even if it was cancer, and you'd think, well, lots of people with cancer, you know, have to get their head shaved or whatever, lose their hair, they come out and they own it and they're open about it and they bring more attention to it and they show the you know, she could show a human side where celebrities show, you know, they, you know, relate to the ordinary person stuff.
Of course.
But the royals, there's an image that, you know, you have to make a call on that, and it's either one way or the other, you know. And if they don't want to have, you know, the future queen, you know, seen, it's strange, but I think if it was just straight up cancer...
Like, she can't be seen to look defective at all.
Yes. There's an image... to be kept up, that is even way above
chosen average, by God,
celebrity, whatever, you know what I mean. They're celebrities, and you think in a very similar way to other, you know, celebrities. But
they're also the head of the Church of England.
Yes,
and they're literally the titular heads of that church.
Yes, they're like the Pope, and so I don't know, but. Yeah,
I get
that's
you.
Why
I get you.
That's why
they're being cagey may not be quite as odd. They're always caging.
Yeah, and it has to be a judgment call as to whether or not you let the public in on this, you know what I mean? But at the same time, maybe it's something... I think if I was to make a a call on it, I would say that if it was just cancer, and all that she was going to have to deal with was just maybe losing some weight, you know, and it wasn't, and if it's, you know, a relatively benign type of cancer, and one that can, has a good chance of being cured with chemotherapy, that they probably would have done that. She may have opted to, you know, to go public with it and show a human side, you know, uh-huh. To the people. But that's why I think it's more likely to be some kind of neurological issue with as a result of vaccine injury, and the main reason for not going public with it is because it would bring up questions about vaccine injury.
Yeah.
And that's why it can't happen. So there's national security involved here.
Yeah. I bet in hindsight, that's the tack that Thailand's royal family had taken. Crazy story. Maybe there's some parallels here. In a sense, no, that's even crazier. So December 2021, the eldest daughter, who is next in line to be queen, mm-hmm. Drops. Not dead. Drops and is put into or immediately falls into a medical coma.
Mm-hmm.
Out walking her dogs. And she's been in it since. And she got not only did she get vaccinated and showed off that she was getting vaccinated like the British royals, she and her father specifically put a lot of the crown's money into getting AstraZeneca over to Thailand to mass produce there, mm-hmm. and getting it out because there was not enough uptake, they
mm-hmm.
thought,
mm-hmm.
and put themselves up first in line,
mm-hmm.
to be jabbed. So
yeah, probably something similar. The British version.
See this comment here. See the last one.
One thing is that although I missed you guys, there doesn't seem much has changed in the world. It's still the same. Clown show, shoe show.
Exactly. Do we need to do this? You get the picture, right? Yeah. Like, the more, is there a French expression, the more things change, the more things stay the same, right?
Mm-hmm. It's funny. Yeah, go ahead.
I said I'd say something about the weather. I don't know if this is, I haven't really paid attention to it, but Europe's has been choppy as hell, the way it's so changeable day to day.
Mm-hmm.
The last month, yeah. Easily. This has got to be related. I was speculating on Twitter that, you know, the solar storms might have had something to do with it. That's tenuous, I know. The science on that's very young or weak. But did you know that Tonga volcanic eruption in 2022, it was a couple of weeks before the SMO was launched, was the largest since Krakatoa. In 1883. It took them a while, like when an event happens in politics, they have to study it and so on. They'd never seen it before and they didn't know it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
The blast was so strong that you had material, including mostly steam, water vapor, perforate the stratosphere and get into the mesosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still floating up there.
Mm-hmm.
Something like, I have a paper on it, but I won't read it all out now. It's something like 3 cubic kilometers of material circulating the globe, has done multiple times since then. It's just sitting up there, but it's important because it's a nuclei condensing agent
for rain.
But that's one issue. Say the dust particles or the other chemicals like sulfur dioxide, whatever's formed from an underwater volcanic eruption. Each one differs. But just in water vapor itself, it increased the quantity of water vapor in the atmosphere total by, this paper says, 13% in the space of fucking hours. Mm-hmm. I mean, man-made global warming, climate change, increased precipitation, you know, that's all like kind of maybe, and there's some human factor, some cosmic solar factor, and off it goes.
Mm.
But then you get one explosion and it goes up here. Okay, and now here's the new baseline. So in that 2 years we've had since then, we live in a new reality where there's 13% more water,
mm-hmm.
at least.
Well, that's
water just, that could fall.
That is one factor in contributing to increased precipitation, because there's those, I mean, it's still unknown. Nobody's done a study on them, but there's those events on Ventusky on the radar maps, you know, on the weather maps, Ventusky.com or
sure.
or Windy.com, etc. But it was in Ventusky that they showed in the South Atlantic, just off the south off the west coast of South Africa, these big wave anomalies. There's been, I think there's been three of them since February, more or less equally interspersed wave anomalies that. Because you can look at wave heights around the world, you can have all these different parameters, and you look at wave heights, and they showed up on three different occasions, wave heights of up to like 80 feet.
Yeah.
Like massive waves just kind of erupting in a large area. You're talking about hundreds of square kilometers. And then they had it projected in their models and moving forward and causing tidal waves.
You know, yeah,
massive
yeah.
waves on the east, on the west coast of Africa.
Yeah.
But then none of that happened. Then they took it away. So one plausible... Because that area is prone to outgassing, and there's a kind of methane substrate. It's basically the sea floor. Uh-huh. It's got a lot of methane just underneath it, and it's also prone to kind of undersea earthquakes or, you know, seabed earthquakes.
So you South Atlantic.
Yeah, so you have, historically it's been known for that. So you have these things popping up, and one explanation is that the sensors that would that read, you know, different parameters and of the weather and the sea
boys.
And stuff, buoys basically, that they confused the this outgassing of methane. Vast amount of methane outgassing over hundreds of kilometers, hundreds of square kilometers for waves. And that's why because they don't have a sensor for methane, right? So the sensors went, oh, that's a wave. You know, they confused the sensor and it just said, that's a wave. And then they deleted it because there were no waves.
But it kept
something
happening.
It happened again. It happened on three occasions, yeah, since February. You know, so it's possible that you have an area there that is becoming very active and is releasing vast amount of methane, which is obviously a... kind of a quote-unquote greenhouse gas, but it also ultimately has turned into water in the it interacts with oxygen and turns into
and
increases water vapor in the
we don't know because they don't talk about it. Therefore, if it's not talked about, it won't be studied. But if it were,
yeah, well, how would
that quantity compare with what the total estimated CO2 emissions are?
It would make human CO2 emissions
dwarf.
Or humans' effect on the climate virtually irrelevant, basically, compared to what's happening.
And it can
naturally.
Just be burped out instantly.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can have 40 days of rain somewhere, you know. Anyway, it's funny that guy mentioned, who was it mentioned? Yeah, Clown Shoes World, because do you know the other day I was attacked by a bunch of clowns? Circus clowns in the car park.
Crazy.
Yeah. I won though because I went right for the juggler.
The jugular.
No, the juggler.
The juggler.
Anyway, on that hilarious clown shoes note, we will leave it there this week, folks. We thank you for watching and for commenting. Hope you enjoyed the show. And sorry for our hiatus, but we'll probably be back next week with another show on some topic that we dream up, because obviously there's not much happening on the planet, as we just mentioned. Somebody commented that there's not much going on, so we'll have to make some stuff up. So we'll be back next week with another show on that made-up stuff. So until then, have a good week.
See you next time.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Can't stop the signal now.